This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even though I knew he had lung cancer, I was stunned and, of course, very sad when I heard last night that Peter Jennings died. It was only 4 months ago that he left his anchor desk at ABC's World News Tonight after signing off by telling us about his illness. September would have marked his 22nd anniversary as the sole anchor of the program. From 1978 to 83, he served as the foreign anchor, sharing the anchor duties with Frank Reynolds and Max Robinson. With Jennings' death comes the end of an era in TV news. Within the past year, CBS anchor Dan Rather and NBC's Tom Brokaw stepped down. We're going to listen back to a 1998 interview with Peter Jennings. He had just co-authored a book chronicling the major events and changes of the 20th century. I asked him how he'd seen journalism change since the early 60s when he started working in television.
Technology, I think, has probably changed my business more in the last 10 or 15 years than it has since the invention of radio and television, because it has obligated us to work with such speed now that sometimes we don't even have time to stop and think what we're doing. I don't think a lot of people necessarily agree with me, but I think that in some respects reporting has been made much more difficult with the advent of instant technology all over the world. When I was a young reporter living in the Middle East, I could go to India, as I did, for example, in 1971 to cover the Indo-Pak War, and I would go off in the morning and cover something, and then I would take the film and I'd send it down to Dum Dum Airport at Calcutta, and someone would hand carry it to Bangkok if I were lucky, and then hand carry it on to Tokyo where they'd process it and put it on the satellite to Los Angeles and landline it to California. Is the process just to get the film back. I could then go on reporting for another 12 or 14 hours and go to downtown Calcutta and rent a radio studio from All India Radio, just like sitting here today, write my copy with a far greater measure of perspective, I think, than I would have the opportunity today, where I would just simply punch my camera in or my tape recorder in and just go live. So the perils of going live are very demanding for reporters.
It seems to me the role of the anchor has changed somewhat since you started in broadcasting. Your first stint as an anchor was it 1963, 65?
No, 1965.
1965.
I used to do it in short pants.
You mean because you were so young?
Precisely.
Right. Yeah, you were, what, 26 or something?
Not to mention unqualified. Yes, 26.
Yeah, that is, even by today's standards, very, very young for an anchor. What was expected of an anchor then that's maybe different from today?
Well, what I was an anchor then was to somehow fit in the general overall trend of the ABC television audience at the time, which was young. I think Gidget was the number one show at the time when I was doing it, and I was the youngest guy around. I had my hair and my teeth. Ironically, some things haven't changed. I was expected to write a lot on the evening news then. I didn't do it very well. The anchor person is, in most news organizations, now most of the major news organizations, now a very senior editor. And so I'd be one of the two or three senior editors in the whole news division now, certainly the senior editor on my own broadcast. You're also expected to do an awful lot of live programming and be available to do an awful lot of live programming, to anchor, in my case, all of the political coverage as well. Sometimes the burden, I think, on the anchor person is rather too much. It sounds a little self-indulgent, but when I got this job the second time round, after having been a foreign correspondent for 20 years, I thought that I would, you know, read magazines instead of newspapers now and books instead of magazines. And it's a much more demanding job hour by hour than I had thought it was going to be, because it has so many components to it.
Do you write your own copy?
I do on the evening broadcast, either write or rewrite almost all of it. I do it for a variety of reasons. I do it because it's very subjective, so if you find someone who writes exactly like you do, it's pretty unusual. It's a great way to copy edit as well and check for facts. It's a great way to add perspective if you've had any experience on a particular issue.
I find your copy really very kind of clear and concise and direct.
It wasn't always thus. Oh, God, I had a producer once many years ago who gave me a Christmas present on common English usage. I was just
what was your problem?
It may be the way I speak sometimes. I would make for lousy sound bites. I tend to use a lot of inverted phrases and ifs, ands, wherefores, and maybes, because that's rather the way I look at life. And so I find writing the evening news sometimes very challenging. because I realize that what we're trying to give folks in the evening is black and white, when so often I want to give them gray.
I used to live in Buffalo, so I recognize the Canadian out and about, which is a little different than the American out and about. And so I'm wondering, when you started anchoring, whether you were given any heat about the kind of Canadian vowels.
I was, indeed. Mind you, I, knowing you're from Buffalo reminds me that when I grew up in Toronto, we wanted something exciting to do, we went to Buffalo. Now you grow up in Buffalo, you want something exciting to do, you go to Toronto. When I came down from Canada in the early 1960s, I was, looking back on it, I was incredibly pompous and determined. And so I did think I could get away with saying things like lieutenant instead of lieutenant and bean instead of bin. And but it's pretty difficult after all those years to change outhouse. I've got rid of most of them now. But as I really am amazed that people put up with me as long as they did in those early days.
Having come from Canada, does it strike you that Canadian and U.S. culture are much different or very similar?
I think they're both very similar in many ways and very different, I think, in some ways for some people. And to some extent, that may be generational. You know, in the United States, we grow up with the notion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Canada, you grow up to a greater extent with citizenship, good government, and never cross a street against a red light. I took my son up to a World Series game in Toronto when the Blue Jays were in the World Series, and we had an awesome evening, and the Blue Jays won, and there was quite a lot of beer consumed, and we all came out of the Sky Dome in Toronto. And as I said, a lot of beer had been consumed, and one cop on Front Street put up his hand, and we all stopped. And I thought to myself, boy, home again. But yeah, so I think very different. And I also think that this is very true about Canadian journalists who've come here. Canada is a very large country with a small population living next door to a large country with an enormous population, which has made such an extraordinary difference in the world, especially in this century. And so I think that Canadians have a slightly more refined notion of the value of influence. Americans grow up with a sense of power, and Canadians are obliged by their state to grow up with a sense of influence.
I'm wondering if there's anything that that is common now in television journalism that violates the rules that you were taught when you were first coming of age in television journalism.
Well, I think it depends a lot on your background. I grew up, my father was a great broadcaster in Canada, one of the early broadcasters on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has always done in Canada what NPR does here. He beat it into my head as a child that you didn't invade people's privacy unless there was a very demanding reason for it. And the demanding reason, for me, is invariably an impact on public responsibility or one's public job. So the greatest difficulty I have in general is invading someone's privacy. Have had my own invaded on more than one occasion. And so I rather wish there was a way in which we could all draw back somewhat and have, if not, you can't abandon it, of course, but if people who did this sort of thing paused every time they were thinking about invading someone's privacy for circulation reasons and could have some clear understanding of what impact that might have on that person's life.
Something that I think might have changed since the days you started in television. I think it used to be considered a violation of the rules on television if a reporter was also a news analyst. And now, for instance, Sunday morning, Cookie Roberts and Sam Donaldson are news analysts and freely give their opinions, but then during the week they're reporting on Congress and the White House, respectively. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, I think it depends, to be perfectly honest. In some respects, I'm Sam and Cokie's editor on the evening news, and one of the things that impresses me about both of them is that they are able to work as analysts and commentators on Sunday, and yet I defy the audience to discover where they're not acting as reporters, unless I ask Cokie, for example, to be an analyst in the course of the week on the evening news. One of the things that's always impressed me about Sam Donaldson, and I think has impressed almost everybody he's ever covered, is how fair he is. I think in all of these instances where reporters are sometimes analysts and, I grant you, sometimes columnists, the most effective thing the audience can do is to just bear it in mind. I try to explain to people, you know, that we all have bias. We all have baggage. I am a white, middle-aged man from the former British Commonwealth with very little education, very little formal education, and some strong biases about some strong issues. I want people to be aware of those so that when they watch and listen to what I do, they know where I'm coming from. I also like people to understand that the bias you see or you think you hear and see in journalism is far less prevalent on the air than it is in the selection process of what we do. I give you one example. I've been very interested since the beginning of the AIDS crisis in the burden that AIDS is on the society as a whole. And I was very lucky. I worked on a series for public television when it was a scare subject. And so I learned a lot thanks to this program called the AIDS Quarterly on which I worked. And as a result, I have a very strong notion that AIDS is a national issue and I want to get past all the bias points. So I'm very happy that people understand that bias and when they see something on our air about bias. But I think the audience should think that about everybody, that they should understand that we all have some baggage. And that's okay. We would be very boring people if we didn't have baggage.
We're listening back to a 1998 interview with Peter Jennings. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview with Peter Jennings. He died of lung cancer yesterday. He was 67. Now, your father was in the news business, I think at the CBC in Canada.
He was.
What did he do?
He was the first national radio anchor person or anchor man that Canadian radio ever had. And so 50 years ago, no, God, no, 60, 70 years ago, my father was doing the national news on the radio for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, coast to coast every night, and he did all of the live broadcasting, too, for the opening of Parliament and great state events. I learned from my father about live broadcasting, and I learned a lot from him. I learned, which I'm not giving a very good example of today, I learned to let other people talk and silences to have as much impact. I love, for example, covering funerals. I learned how to cover a funeral from my father, who used to say to me, "Be sure we hear the horse's hooves."
In other words, stop talking for a while.
Stop talking for a while and let people hear the gun carriage go by.
Well, what you did early on in 1965 was to anchor for ABC, as you said, at the age of 26. This was after Frank Reynolds' death. I think you were opposite Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley?
Mm-hmm. I was at a lunch once with Chet and David. Chet, as you know, is dead now. Walter Cronkite is still a good friend, had been immensely kind to me when I'd come down from Canada. We went to a lunch here in New York, Chet Huntley and Walter Cronkite and young Peter Jennings, and some man stood up in the audience and said, "You know, you guys are just like you, all right, you guys are just in show business." And Brinkley drew himself up to his haughtiest height and said, "Excuse me, the only concession I make to show businesses is on the way to the studio, I stop in the makeup room, and I have these bags under my eyes painted out." And Cronkite piped in, "Yes," and Jennings stops in and has them painted on. That's how young I was.
Did you feel very uncomfortable? Did you feel like you were like the young, handsome guy who was cast in this position because he was young and handsome?
Well, I did it for 3 years. For the first 2 years, I was too stupid to feel awkward about it, which meant I was probably too full-headed. And by about the end of the second year, just before the Arab-Israeli War broke out in 1967, I realized enough already. I hated it. I went off to the Middle East at the end of the 1967 war and came back to my employers and said, "That's enough. I want out of here." And they said, "Yes." Very eagerly, I realized. I think that would have been only a matter of time before they'd have fired me. And off I went. And I never thought I'd come back. I never thought I would anchor again, because I was so happy for the intervening 20 years.
One of the things you did as a foreign correspondent was you opened the Beirut Bureau, mm-hmm. which was the first ABC bureau in an Arab country, and mm-hmm. you were there for, I think, 7 years?
Oh, 6 years.
Tell me why ABC opened a bureau there at the time.
Well, I think we were very self-conscious at the end of the 1967 war that the press corps had rather cheered for the Israelis. and got to the end of the war and realized that there hadn't been much coverage from the other side. The only person we had on the other side of any significance was Charles P. Arno, wonderful foreign correspondent who died just a few months ago in Arizona. And he'd been in Cairo, and the Egyptians had put him on a train, sent him to Alexandria, and before he knew it, he was on a Greek island. And I think that people felt that that the whole region was not being covered with as much balance or as interest as we might have, because the region, as you know, after 1967 got very, very, very interesting. And so I was living in Rome, going back and forth, and they said, we'd like you to go and live in Beirut. I said, no, I live in Rome. And they said, we'd like you to go live in Beirut. And I said, excuse me, you don't understand me. I live in Rome, Rome, eh? And was having an awesome time. Well, when they said it the third time, I said, yes, quite. And I went and lived in Beirut, of course, turned out to be even better than Rome. But I had as my responsibility for all those years, everything east of the Mediterranean, all the way to India. And at India, the Hong Kong correspondent picked up. So I had all of the Arab world. I had the territories that were occupied by Israel. I had Greece and I had Cyprus and occasionally Turkey. I had Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, I was thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Well, one of your colleagues, Charles Glass, was kidnapped in Beirut, and I think you were anchoring the news at that time, and probably you were anchoring when the footage was played of him making a kind of forced confession.
Mm-hmm.
I think about what being tied to the CIA or something, which mm-hmm. which
yeah, Charlie was here. Yeah, Charlie was here the other day. He's more than a colleague of mine. I trained him.
Mm.
I took him to India as a sound man. I never forget. He used to carry the microphones in his socks. We get in front of some very important person we have to interview, and there'd be Charlie shaking out his socks so that the microphones would fall out onto the floor. So he was much more, but indeed he was kidnapped in Lebanon in the process of writing a book, and he'd planned to write a book about going from the Syrian-Iraqi border or Syrian-Turkish border down into Egypt and writing a wonderful, which he wrote a very good book called Tribes with Flags, but it got interrupted when he was kidnapped in Lebanon. And I was on the air here doing the stock market crash or the stock market Black Tuesday. And suddenly somebody put on the air this picture of Charlie confessing to being a CIA agent. And it just, it's one of the few times I think I ever lost it on television.
How much did you lose it?
Enough to have to apologize to the audience minutes later.
Were you seeing this footage for the first time?
I was seeing it for the first time. It was a producer's mistake in some respect. Somebody should have told me it was in the house and we could have looked at it in a break, but they didn't. They rushed to get it on the air. And so I saw it cold for the very first time. It was very hard.
What were you seeing?
Charlie sitting there looking like hell, admitting that he was a CIA agent. And I could see, I knew the situation so well, I could just see the guy standing just off camera, just out of frame, you know, with their AK-47s or whatever pointed at him. Yeah, it was very tough.
I imagine that there have been other times when you've been anchoring live news coverage of something and a story has broken that has been greatly shocking and you're kind of narrating the story as it happens. Yes?
Yeah, I don't want to portray myself as being cold-blooded, but I've had other times. I remember when Ronald Reagan went down to the memorial service for the Challenger families after the Challenger disaster, and he went to Houston, and President Reagan, as you know, who had this extraordinary capacity to comfort people. Bill Clinton has some of the same, but Ronald Reagan could hold a mother in his arms, albeit briefly, and you could feel the comfort oozing out of him, not only for the individual, but for the country. And in the background, the whatever band it was playing, the Navy hymn, and I just thought that was too much for me. But in the main, I've always felt very strongly, was trained to believe that expressions of emotion, other than happiness has always seemed to be an acceptable mood to communicate, but that I never thought it was my job to have other people know precisely how I was feeling about anything on the earth. They have enough trouble dealing with their own feelings.
When is happiness okay?
I think at the end of the news, if a story that we've done is clearly funny, or if I can feel people around, if I've written a closing item to the broadcast and people around me smile, I think it's okay for me to smile. I just don't think I think that crying on television is a bit demeaning to everybody, but mostly to the audience.
One last question. When you first anchored the news in 65, was there anything that was different about the nature of stories, their length, their content, what qualified as an appropriate news story compared to now in 1998?
Oh, no, I think if you go back and look at those days, I occasionally hear my friend Don Hewitt at CBS, from whom I learned a lot, railing about the old days. If you go back and look at a newscast from the 1960s or the 70s or even the early 80s and compare on a good day to what we do today, we're doing an infinitely better job today. Our techniques are better. Our reporters are much more specialized today than they were 25 years ago. The ability to communicate a story is vastly greater. People used to laugh at us for the graphics innovations of the news programs, but in fact, graphics have enabled us to communicate much more complicated stories. If you watch. We do a series on World News Tonight. John McKenzie, one of our medical reporters, do some of the most avant-garde medical reporting there is on television. They could never do it without graphics, but because we now have the computer-age graphics that we do, it's totally easy to understand stem cells and how they work and DNA, and that would never have happened 20-some-odd years ago.
Well, Peter Jennings, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, very much. Thank you for giving us the time.
Peter Jennings, recorded in 1998. He died of lung cancer yesterday. He was 67. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.